Welcome to Dissecting Education, where we take a spherical look at the education landscape from many vantage points. I'm your host, Dr. Melanie Hicks. Glad you're here with us today. Let's get started. All right, today's guest, we have Dr. Angela Long. She's a nationally recognized speaker, researcher, and author. She formerly served under the Chancellor of the Florida College System as the Director of Learning Innovation Success within the Division of Florida Colleges. She is also the co-editor of Innovative Ideas for Community College, a national book series. And in the fall of 2016, Dr. Long published a groundbreaking book entitled Overcoming Educational Racism in the Community College, involving education's top researchers, practitioners, and community college leaders to address the educational disparities that exist among students of color. Thank you, Dr. Long, for being here. We are so, so excited.
Thank you. It is an honor and a privilege, Dr. Hicks. And so, listen, I'm so excited to just share with your audience the work that I have been really privileged to be a part of, just the passion that goes into that and the people you meet. So it's wonderful, I would say, to meet like-minded individuals like you that really want to affect change for good in education. So thank you for the opportunity.
Yes, thank you. So let's just kick it off here with a little bit, tell us a little bit more about you, and I'll ask you how were you drawn to the field of education? Kind of where'd you get your start and your first passion?
Well, that's a very good question, a loaded question.
It is.
As we would ask anyone, but I have to say, if we were gonna go all the way back to high school, so I'm originally from Oregon. I come from the West Coast. In fact, my family line, they came by wagon train and it goes all the way back. And so I actually grew up in a very rural community in Southern Oregon in the mountains. And when I was in high school, you know, I loved education. I loved children. But I have to say where my story really starts in terms of where I've become with this passion of mine for community college leadership and education is when I was a senior, I had opportunity to sign up for a skills competition. We had a great and still do community college in the area. And this is in Douglas County. Well, Umpqua Community College was the local college where most students went if they didn't go off to university. And like most students in high school, when you're a senior and you talk to your friends and they say, oh, are you going to go to University of Oregon or Oregon State University? And you say, no, I'm going to go to planning going to a community college. There's a little bit of embarrassment. You're like, it's not quite the same level of university. But I have to say, as a senior, I didn't want to go to college right away. And I told my parents flat out, I said, I'm going to work. I'm taking a year off. I said, listen, it's grade 13. And my dad said, well, you know, if you do that, you're going to buy a car, you'll get a job. He said, and you may never go. And my brother, I have an older brother who actually is a dentist. He's very smart, very advanced. So he right away, I mean, right out of high school, he was, I mean, by 19 had his AA degree and he was good to go. So, I ended up randomly winning, I say random, but I think it was meant to be a scholarship in journalism at a skills competition at the local community college. Well, they offered me, after I won this essay contest, they offered me my first term. So Melanie, I went, and I have to tell you, it changed my life. I remember walking across campus and I was just like, wow, everybody's so friendly and kind, and something happened to me. And I had that 4.0 that first semester. I loved it. I got involved with sports. I was in track and field. And I just said, you know what? This is my path. Well, from that point, I made a decision after I got my 2-year degree, my Associate of Arts, that I was going to go into education. And that's a whole nother story in and of itself. But I have to tell you, that decision to attend a community college changed my life. And I went straight through school. My undergrad is in elementary education. My master's is in school counseling and consultation. And then I went on, I was actually very young. I was 24 when I was admitted into a doctoral program focused on community college leadership. And so that experience was, again, life-changing because, and I won't, you stop me any moment.
No, you're fine.
But really, this is where the story launches. So not only did I attend a community college, you know, sometimes we think, oh, it's, you know, you're going to community college. No, it is such a smart choice. You save money, you get engaged, you're not a number, you're a name, right? And so I had that sense of what this means to educate. And I think because looking back to my K through 12, you know, the workbooks and worksheets and open to page 55, I'm like, no, there's more to education than this. I could affect education. So these thoughts started, I would say, very early on. But when I went to get my dissertation and or my doctorate and focusing on my dissertation, I will never forget I needed a job because they had said, Angela, you have to have 3 years experience at a community college. I will tell you, I didn't have it. So they kind of bent the rules,
right?
Where, but they said, go get experience. It will be okay. We'll work this out. So I went back to my local community college and I went to the director of counseling and I said, is there any way you can offer me an opportunity to work here so I can, you know, work as I'm going through school and getting this experience at the community college? And they said, yes. So Melody, this is what happened. I became an advisor in their advising center, part-time. And then I was asked to start testing students with GEDs that wanted to earn their GED and come to the college. And so to try to make this story shortened, but it's a powerful story, I walked into this not really realizing, because I never thought about students who dropped out. Mm-hmm. I had a high school diploma. And so what happened, I started testing these individuals. Now we had a unique program. The college that I went to school and also began to work, they had an opportunity if you had been a dropout, if you tested on site and you passed, you had a free term at the community college. Free stuff. Wow. Everyone.
That's a great benefit.
Amazing benefit. Well, one day the vice president of student affairs came to me and she knew I was very energetic. And she said, Angela, I have a request. And I said, yes. She said, I would like for you to start tracking the number of students that come to us after earning their GED, getting that scholarship, how many complete. So Melanie, basically to make a long story short, out of 365 students, half dropped out within the first few weeks of attending the college experience. The remaining half dropped out by the next semester. After 2 years, only 11 went on to complete their AA. Ugh. And in my heart, I said, something doesn't add up. This is not right. Well, unfortunately, I shared that they dropped the scholarship program, but that's what launched, I would say, my national work. I flew back to DC. I met with people and just knocked on doors very boldly. And I asked the director of longitudinal studies at the National Center for Education Statistics. I said, sir, would you sit on my committee? He said, I would love to. Nobody's asked me to do that. But he gave me access to national data. And I was able to do a national study that launched my work. I would say to doing what I'm doing today, which I haven't got into, but I'll let you ask the next question.
No, that's really fascinating. You know, there is a real debate in the higher education world about community college and its value. And I see it a lot with sort of parents, right? So I have a lot of colleagues and friends who have children that are coming up and about to go or making that choice about four-year college, whatever. And you know, we were just a couple of friends of mine, one of which has a high school daughter who's making these choices. And the other friend who went through the community college system, I did not. I went straight to a four-year school. And so we were having a whole kind of three women discussion around the value, because like you, my friend Lana, who is now a mental health counselor and professional with a master's degree, and she said, I would not have succeeded if it wasn't for the community college experience I had. I needed that kind of small microcosm of education to build my confidence, to connect me with education in a new way that I didn't feel in high school, and all of these things, very similar to the way that you felt about your community college. So that's very powerful. And I think something that more people really need to know, that even smart students from good families can benefit from the smaller, more individualized experience that a community college can offer. It's not just a last resort or a side, you know, for the student who maybe, you know, that we think of as the GED participant, for example. Not that it's not open for that. I think that's what's great about community colleges. They really have this wide open door policy, right? It's education equality at its best, right?
Absolutely.
So tell me about your first, and maybe it is the same, but do you have an even earlier first education memory, even prior to kind of your community college experience?
Besides the fact that, I don't know if this was you, but you know, as a very little girl, I remember lining up my stuffed animals and dolls. I don't know if you ever did that. And yes. I was a teacher. So, you know, going back to that point, there was just something in me that I just wanted to give back, you know? And so I would just say, you know, it really, for my knowledge of becoming a teacher, I thought about it when I was in elementary school, obviously middle school. And, but then there was a point where I said, you know what, maybe I should be a veterinarian. I did an internship, decided after, you know, they castrated a sheep. I said, nope, I don't think I'm going to go into that field. but I knew that with the way that things are going in education, it was just, it's one of those things where, you know, you step forward in faith, just, am I going to walk the right path I'm called to do? For me, I'm a big person to say, what's my purpose? And I think that answering that question, what is my purpose, is on everyone's mind. And I think we see that today with students when they come in. You know, if they can't answer the why education for what question, then we lose them. Mm-hmm. And so I'll say with regard to community colleges, when you look at the national data, literally 50% of all students that enroll drop out. And so you have to say, look, if we were a CEO of a company and you lost that many of your employees, you shouldn't be a CEO of your company. Yet we're finding more and more. And then I think that really led to my next bit of research focusing on race. Because when you start disaggregating the data, it's actually very shocking. Most people don't realize, but when you look at the data with regard to Black student achievement, Hispanic student achievement, it is really shocking to see the numbers. And so one of the things I will say is most people don't realize, besides the fact that nearly half of all community college students drop out of college within their first term, only 7 out of 10 students of color actually complete. And so that's 10 to 12% who are graduating college. If you look at students who are in poverty, even poor whites, you're looking at 20% graduating from college. And I think really looking at that data, as I just moved forward in my career and I started working and teaching at a college and you know, like I said, my doctorate was in the community college leadership. I just began to really investigate. And I'll tell you this, I'm a person who is not afraid to knock on a door. In fact, my dad's always said, what's the worst that could happen? They could say no. Well, that's okay. You move forward, right? But I believe, Melanie, and I'd love to hear from you, it only takes one person to change a system for good or bad. And so sometimes I think we look at our lives and we say, oh, you know what, it's just me. And that's a wrong attitude. Because look at our country today. There's so much going on. There's political polarity. I mean, there's so much, not just in our nation, but in the world. Mm-hmm. But in education, we're on a major shift. Mm-hmm. And so I will just say now is the time as educators to begin the process to innovate and ask the tough questions. Why do we do what we do?
Yeah, I cannot agree with you more. I think, you know, the good news about crisis, the silver lining of kind of crisis or chaos is the opportunity to innovate in a more rapid and a more kind of, I don't know the word I'm trying to say, but just, you know, it opens our minds to innovation out of necessity, right? And by proxy of that, we get to have progression, right? And I also completely agree. It is often frustrating when you are the first one to take a stand, right? The first one to raise your hand and say, something's not right here. And quite honestly, most of us who have ever been in a position where we stood up and we took a stand, it doesn't always end, you know, the way that we had hoped. We don't always get the crowning victory. It's not a Hallmark movie at the end, right? But if you are confident in yourself and confident in your mission, your purpose or the cause that you're standing up for, then you know you're planting a mustard seed and people can, you know, follow in your footsteps later, right? So I recently listened to a podcast, and I'm going to get the name of it wrong, unfortunately, but I think it's called You're Wrong About, but it talked about Shannon Faulkner and her experience at the Citadel in the early 90s. And, you know, fast forward, and she had a really horrible time there, and a very controversial nationwide controversy, all of these things. And then if you look today, they just elected their first female student body president, Right. So the time difference is, you know, 20 plus years have had to go by, not really recognizing her as the person who the student body president was interviewed, and they asked if Shannon Faulkner was an inspiration to her. And the student didn't know who that was. Right. So her, you know, the legacy of the first female student admitted to the Citadel has passed on without recognition. However, the idea of integrating women into this school has not, right? And so even if you don't get the credit for it, your legacy lives on. And that's, to me, that's very inspirational. To me, that is why I want to get up every day and talk about the hard things and work towards the causes I'm passionate about, because you never know, you know, behind you, who will benefit from that. You can't predict it, and you just don't know. So,
yeah. Absolutely.
So tell me a little bit more about your book. What a prevalent topic. I mean, this book came out in 2016, not that it wasn't just as important then, but certainly in terms of societal lens of attention and looking at it, there is nothing, very little more in our forefront than the issue of race and discrimination in all different venues, but particularly at the education level. So tell me a little bit about your book, about how it started and kind of some of the lessons that you're really proud of from that.
Yeah, I would love to. Thank you for the question. So I will say that prior to that book, actually, I mentioned my national work focused on, you know, studying students with GEDs. But mm-hmm. when you look at students with GEDs, you're talking about 1 out of 7 Americans. Mm-hmm. Most people don't realize it's that large of a number, but demographically, you're dealing with all types of students from age, from race, from socioeconomic status that have GEDs. Well, when I moved to Florida, I came to Florida and I started working at a community college, Santa Fe College. And when I came, I was the director or coordinator of student leadership and activities. So I worked with student leadership, and I will tell you really where the book came out of is I started focusing with our student leadership on helping at-risk students, specifically with GEDs. And then I'll tell you where that led into this next book focused on just race. But the student leadership members, we actually took a trip. This is when Obama was president. We took a trip to DC. We started a program focused on helping students with GEDs. It was called Pathways to Persistent Scholars Program. But I have to tell you, we ended up doing this trip before that program came about with our student body president, 18 students, and we were invited to go meet the Undersecretary of Education. It was in that meeting she began to talk about the dropout crisis in America. Mm-hmm. And so she looked at all the students that I had been working with, and she said, listen, if you guys can come up with a solution or something you would recommend to President Obama, we're listening. Wow. And I remember leaving, yes, I know, Melanie, sometimes things come about and you don't plan. I remember leaving that meeting. I was like, oh, wow, well, you know, that's great. And so we came back from the trip. And the students, the student body president, Austin, at the time, he came to me one day. He goes, you know, he said, Dr. Long, I really believe, he said, that we could come up with something. He said, your graduate level work and what we do here in student government, we could actually put a proposal together. So Melanie, a group of students and myself wrote a 41-page document. This kind of is the impetus, I would say, for me getting into the publishing world. Mm-hmm. Sometimes you don't realize where you're headed.
Right?
Yeah. Yeah. So we wrote a 41-page document focused on 6 factors that I actually had developed from my dissertation, mm-hmm. and developed a program to present to our president and to take up to DC to present to the Undersecretary of Education. So we went to our president, Dr. Jackson Sasser at the time, and the students, we handed him the 41-page document. He goes, well, this is great, you know, kids. And he looked at it, and then he read it, and he called us and he said, this is amazing. He said, I tell you what, I'm going to pay for your tickets to fly up to DC to go meet with the undersecretary. So we all flew together.
Oh my gosh, that's awesome.
Arne Duncan's boardroom, I will never forget it. We presented our proposal. And it was after that our president said, I'm going to fund your idea, the student's idea, and what you all have done jointly. And so that really launched this work, like frontline work. It's not just theory. We're going to put it into action. It was so successful, what we were seeing in terms of retention and persistence and this learning community that had been built. And it was student-led. And so there was all these components. that when it was all said and done, after a few years of doing that, in my heart, and I took these students everywhere, they presented at Achieving the Dream. We went back up, they presented before White House staff. It was really quite amazing, honestly. And I'll never forget one meeting, a gentleman came up to me and he gave me his card. He said, you know, I'm so impressed with your students. If there's anything I can do to support you, please let me know. And you know, you take people's cards and you tuck them away and you're like, well, I'll probably never see that person again.
Sure, yeah.
So what happened was, is I had that card and I will never forget, it was on my heart to do a book. And I wanted to focus on students who were kind of the non-traditional underdog and overlooked. And so again, that was the population of students with GEDs. Well, Melanie, I flew up to DC for 3 days to meet with different leaders to talk about my idea. And the gentleman that gave me his card, he worked at the American Association of Community Colleges. And I walked right in his office. I had a meeting. And he said, how can I help you, Angela? And he remembered me. And I said, well, do you remember when you said if there's anything that you could do to support? He said, of course, what can I do? And I said, well, I have this idea, this wild idea to do a book focused on students with GEDs. And I said, would you co-author? He had access to all the national data. He was the policy analyst. And do you know what he said without hesitating? He said, I would love to. In fact, he had a GED and it was on his heart. So it was like meant to be.
It really was.
Within a year, we gathered people all over the country that worked with this population, focusing on, you name it, different areas, even developmental math experts, talking about developmental education. And Melanie, within a year, we found a publisher. It was published. That book was called America's Forgotten Student Population. Mm-hmm. I became this co-editor, right, of this national book series. And how that came about, which led to book two, focused on race, is my publisher, he's from England, my co-editor or the editor of the series, she's from New York, and we met in a French restaurant to talk about the opportunities.
Oh, I love it. I love it so much.
Yeah, so she's a beautiful Jewish woman, and he's English, and we're eating French food, talking about, well, should we do a series on innovative ideas for community colleges? And he agreed to it. And so she and I began to co-edit the series. And out of that, we were literally sitting down one day and it was heavy on my heart because I was looking at the research and I was saying to myself, we need to focus on a book on race. And the topic was not focused on racism. It was focused on, you know, looking at different demographic groups across the country and their persistence and retention in the college system, right? Mm-hmm. So essentially what came from that is I began to knock on doors and I would call folks from the you know, top level and say, who would you recommend to have a say in this? So we said, look, this book is gonna focus on five demographics. We're going to look at Hispanic students. We're going to look at Black students. We're going to look at American Indian, Asian and Pacific Islander. And then of course the poor whites. People don't really talk about Caucasian. Right. Poverty, but when you go to Appalachia area, if not even Florida, it's heavy, heavy poverty.
Yeah.
And so I was very blessed, Melanie. I was put in touch with, I mean, top level researchers across the country, top level presidents, college presidents. And I actually had the president of the American Association of Community Colleges, Dr. Walter Bumpus. He wrote the foreword to the book. And this book, essentially, it's broken up into these five sections, but each section has the voice of a national researcher, the voice of a national leader who is very passionate, and then the voice of a college president who has really put the work together on their campuses to have an outcome of higher completion. And so the book literally culminates with these six factors for helping students complete, focused on mentoring, tutoring, learning communities, all the things we know are high impact.
Sure.
But that book has been used all over. I will say, you know, the president of the National Association of Community College Entrepreneurship, I ended up connecting with her to do a third book called Community Colleges as Incubators of Innovation. I'm not the author, I'm the editor of the series. And so I helped her publish that book with her team. And so actually that third book, I don't know if you can see it. The companion book to Overcoming Educational Racism in the Community College. And so there's so many aspects of this to talk about, but I will say this, now is the time to have these critical conversations. So you're right, 2016, that book was published. The reason that the title came out as it did, that was not the original intention. After we compiled the voices, we compiled the data, we looked across the board, we started to see a pattern and a trend. And it was very concerning to me, just the sense of student perceptions, right? When they go into a classroom, sometimes faculty will say, look, I don't have any biases. When I talk to my students, I'm not thinking a thing. Even if that's true, students have a perception. And really, it comes down to two things. And this is what we found. Mm-hmm. Number one, do students have a sense of belonging? And number two, do they know how to navigate the system? So whether you're poor, living in a high poverty area, whether you're a student of color, or you're a combination of both, if you don't feel like you belong, and you don't know how to navigate the system, most of our students walk away. But here's the thing, Melanie, is we are losing human capital of bright, intelligent, amazing people who could make such a difference in society if given the opportunity, and also given the hope that they are intelligent, they have so much to offer, and they have so much to invent, you know?
Yeah. You know, it's interesting that those are the two factors that came out. I did my dissertation on a concept called psychological contract, which is it bridges psychology and business, but it was focused on the workplace and on onboarding. And very similar factors, framed differently, different academic language, but basically in the process, when someone takes a position at a workplace, if they don't know how to navigate the system, and if they don't feel like they belong there, and a lot of that, from a psychological contract perspective, a lot of the belonging is around what was I told in the interview, or what did I already perceive about the job, and how does it line up with what's actually happening? And if it doesn't line up very well, then they start to feel disengaged, right? And so a lot of what's interesting about what you just said about the classroom is it feels like the same. If I show up and I have these preconceived notions in my head, and it's very confusing, and I don't know how to, where to buy my textbooks and how to log on to the online system, and when, what does office hours mean? And, and then at the same time, I had this perception that that the professor was going to care about me and do these, or that it was going to have, I was going to have study buddies in my classes, and I don't have that, then I start to feel disengaged, and you start to have this psychological contract violation, this break, right? And that's what causes people to sort of step away from whatever situation. So that's fascinating that is so similar to something that my research observed in the workplace, right? And that, just slightly framed differently and in different context is what's happening in the classroom as well.
Well, and I'll add to that, really where I'm at today, I work here at a community college. After I published that second book, I had an opportunity came about actually, and I met the chancellor of the Florida college system. What was unique about that is in the second book, Dr. Eduardo Padron, who is now retired, he's the former president of Miami-Dade College. He wrote a chapter, and in his chapter, he had this highlight on the incubation centers, the innovation hubs on their campus. Well, I'm very entrepreneurial minded. Captured my attention, and I called up a friend, a colleague who I knew knows literally everybody, and I said, we're looking to do a next book, and that's where actually the book I just held up came from. And I said, I'm fascinated with this concept of an innovation hub at Miami-Dade College, and I said, do you have a recommendation? He said, yes. He said, actually, the chancellor of the Florida college system, she authored that program. She worked for Dr. Padron. Well, Melanie, I called up one day and I said, I'd like to set up a meeting with this chancellor. I'd like to talk to her about, opportunity of a next book focused on entrepreneurship, the whole bit. Well, I went to meet with her, and long story short, great meeting. She connected me to the president of NACI, but I ended up working there. And so I was hired eventually, applied for a position as the director of learning, innovation, and success, where I collected best practices across the state of Florida. And I worked with the community college system. But here's what's amazing is I was able to take the research and look at it, right? Mm-hmm. And that door opened for me working at the state to talk about best practices. But then another opportunity came a few years later where I'm at today at Tallahassee Community College. And what I'm going to tell you right now, Tallahassee Community College, I'm in a position where I serve as Director of Strategic Engagement. I was recruited over. I have to tell you, I am so grateful to be here because all the things that I've thought about and I've learned and I've taught, I'm seeing it come to life at this college. We sit this. So let me tell you this, this college where I'm at right now, we sit in the poorest zip code 32304 in the state of Florida. Mm-hmm. We are 52% non-white. Obviously the pandemic hit, but I have to tell you quickly before the pandemic hit, in August of 2019, I came on board and our, at the time, provost said, she said, we are going to host a design thinking session. If you're going to impact change in education, the way you do it is you have to build ownership where people have a stake in it, right? And so when I came on board, the college had a 30% equity gap between Black and white student achievement, and that's unacceptable. So we talk about these gaps. And Melanie, I, along with other faculty, we had held a two-day workshop. And in that two-day workshop, we gathered almost 200 faculty and staff, and we asked them, if you could redesign the student experience at Tallahassee Community College, what would that look like? And Melanie, for 2 days, they mapped out all the barriers that they see with students. Then they said, okay, these are strategies we think would overcome those specific barriers. And from that, it took 2 weeks, but we developed a prototype. Well, that prototype became the CARE initiative, the CARE model, and CARE is an acronym that stands for connections, academics, resources, and engagement. And amazing what came of this, because I'm sitting here today for 1 year, and I hope you can hear me. There's like ambulances going by.
It's okay.
Okay, for 1 year, we literally watched faculty and folks in student services and student affairs and our workforce and innovation begin to build this up, build this model up. How do we connect students to the right resources? How do we engage them? How do we build their academic pathways, right? And so we began to take this model to personalize the student experience. Well, then guess what? The pandemic hit. And that model of what these faculty and staff designed based upon research, I have to tell you, it put that CARE initiative to the test, the pandemic did.
I bet.
But you know what happened? Not only did the college go into full gear, they began to switch overnight the learning modalities. And our faculty, many of them that had not been trained with the technology to the level others, you know, have, we did a 2-week training on when a pandemic strikes. How do you utilize Zoom? What are the best ways to engage students in an online platform? Well, our provost came up with a brilliant idea. I mean, overnight, let's have live courses. And live stands for learning interactively in a virtual environment. And they were synchronous. So just like you would meet from 8 to 9, 3 days a week, you know, with your science class, you would do it through Zoom and you would meet live and you would have engaging activities live. And that was launched in the spring, right as the pandemic hit, right after spring break. Well, I have to tell you today where we sit. I'm so grateful. We've been named one of the top 10 colleges in America from the Aspen Institute. That CARE initiative, our achievement, our success of our first time in college students from fall 2018 to fall 2020 went up by almost 9% amongst all demographics. Our Black student achievement has risen. Our Hispanic student achievement has risen. Students that are, you know, in different demographics, mixed, has risen across the board, Melanie. And I'm going to tell you, it's because a group of people here who are passionate, they care, they got together and said, if we could redesign this, what would we do? And I have to tell you, I was a part of that groundwork. And so sitting here today, you know, February 15th, 2021, I look back and I see over the time, the players, the heart of people, it all came together. And there's just more to come, but I share that because all of the recommendations, the factors, it all came to life in my role here at this college, and I'm seeing it firsthand. And so I hope that one day I can share that good work with others and, you know, see what is even better yet to come with this initiative.
Yeah, absolutely. It's interesting. You preempted my questions. I had live on my next question, actually. I know that it has been just a phenomenal success. I did not know the fact about the Aspen Institute giving that recognition. So that is congratulations. You know, I personally had some interactions with TCC back many years ago when Dr. Law was there as their president, and I was in Tallahassee. But it's so amazing to watch what great folks like you and your team and the other really dedicated faculty and staff have been able to do in a kind of a quiet, unknown way, right? Until, you know, just hard work and heart work and, you know, putting students and student achievement and connection as the top priority. So that's really amazing. Congratulations on that.
Well, listen, it was an entire team, and I know we're having a conversation, but there's amazing materials I'd love to share with you just on what's involving with that CARE initiative. And not just hearing from faculty and staff, we went to students, and we actually had a design thinking session with students, and we said, you know, if you could redesign the experience, what would that look like? And it was really profound, because what came from that is the students looked at the work of the faculty and the staff, and they all said simultaneously, wow, you know who we are.
Yeah.
And most of these students said that they come to events for the food because they're hungry. Homelessness is an issue, mm-hmm. you know. But I have to say, I have to brag on my president here, Dr. Jim Murdaugh, because his background, he was a state trooper. He actually was the director of the Florida Public Safety Institute to build up the training of law enforcement officers across the state of Florida. And he doesn't talk much about it, but this is on his heart so much that he goes out and he'll literally see somebody sitting on a bench and say, hey, do you need to go to college? Like, tell me your story. And he'll invest in people and not talk about it. But I just feel like that's the heart of TCC. What he demonstrates really is our mission. And I just am so honored to be at a place where the people here, I mean, that is what they care about. And by golly, we're going to close those equity gaps. And we want to be, you know, a model to the country to see what we could do that maybe other colleges could learn from.
I think that's amazing. So, and I think you probably, you know, have addressed this with your last comments, but so many times in education, we start to become, those of us who work in education for our careers, right, start to become a little jaded, because there are a lot of initiatives that take place, and then either they get, you know, they lose their champion for some reason, someone moves on to another job, or, you know, when a crisis happens, it gets put on the back burner. And so you go through these, you know, a lot of really sometimes well-intentioned, not superficial efforts, and then it just doesn't go anywhere. So what do you think was the real keys or the real kind of sweet spot of why the CARES initiative actually, you know, took hold and became part of the culture there and part of the, you know, that made it successful?
Excellent question. I think it's the hot button question, honestly, of the century,
right.
Maybe decade or the last few decades. Well, it goes back to the ownership of the process. And I think typically when you are working in a college, often there's great ideas, right? And it's a top-down approach. This movement did not start from a top-down approach. Yes, did you have administration meet in advance and say, okay, let's talk about, you know, what do we need to do? What would this look like? But really the power, it came from hosting the design thinking session. It came from hearing from faculty and staff and saying, listen, we want to hear from you. What do you think we need to do? What do you see are issues that we need to solve? And it's not going to be the top down solving it. It's going to be a collective effort. It cannot be siloed. You can't have academic affairs doing their thing and student affairs doing their thing. You literally have to have a collective effort where everybody's on the same page. And so Melanie, the way that we approached it is, number one, we interviewed students and we played the video clips before the faculty and staff for 2 days. We had hosted two different groups and we asked the students, you know, what have you loved about being here? What could be improved? What do you think of our faculty? And we had random, you know, interviews across campus. And so we listened to what the students had to say. We took surveys. We shared the data. We talked about the data, what are our equity gaps, you know, look like. Mm-hmm. And then really we stated this question. It was more of a quote. We are perfectly designed for the outcomes that we see. So if you do nothing to change anything, yeah, you are perfectly designed for the outcomes you see. If we do nothing, our likelihood of improving the success rates is not very high. It's just like when you want to lose weight. If you don't set a goal, you know, you don't have a plan and you just hope to the wind that it's just going to come together, you can gain weight, actually, not lose weight. And so our goal was to say, we have to be intentional with our strategies. But guess what, folks? The strategies are going to come from you and from research. And so we talked about, what are the 7 principles of student success? One of the principles of success is finding meaning and purpose. And I think today, especially with this pandemic, and you see it too, I know mental health is such a big deal. And we have so many students who are struggling and even to get out of bed. Melanie, like I said, that sense of ownership for faculty to say, hey, this is my input, for our student affairs professionals, for staff to say, this is my input. And we literally, I'm not kidding you when I tell you, for 2 weeks, I had hundreds of sticky notes, little post-its that were lining our conference room with other faculty to literally pull it all together. What were the themes? What were the messaging? They all developed prototypes. And from that, we took the core ideas and developed one prototype, which became the CARE Initiative. But it stood the test of time through that pandemic, because mental health was, I mean, the issues were double, yeah, right? Once the pandemic hit, student affairs, they had virtual services. You needed counseling. We had a virtual platform, advising, virtual advising, everything that we did, including Talon's Market. We partner with Walmart, and we have an actual grocery store on campus where if you need food, you can come pick up food. You need care, like for your children, you can get toothpaste, diapers, whatever you need. It's here for free for students. All the partnerships, we couldn't have done it alone. We really needed the community to gather around us, us that we're seeing. But I will say this, you know, when I mentioned, we asked the tough questions, if you could redesign the student experience, what would that look like, right? And so that's where it starts. And I'm going to tell you the premise of that question. And maybe I close with this, but the Sabretooth curriculum, have you ever heard of this book?
I have not.
All right. So for your audience, I would recommend, I know everybody has such free time, but.
Okay. I love it.
The Sabretooth curriculum. It's a book written by J. Abner Pediwell, Peddiwell. And it was actually written in 1939. So, you know, history can repeat itself, right?
Of course.
Yeah, this book is actually a satire. And so this is the premise, I think, of everything that I approach in terms of my life, in terms of my work in education, is focused on the Sabretooth curriculum. So essentially, it's a satire, it's a story. And it goes back to the caveman times, right? And it's during the Ice Age. And everything obviously is very, you know, cold. You've got the saber-toothed tigers, you've got little woolly mammoths that run around, and then you have fishing. And so basically the tribesmen of this caveman community, they developed a curriculum to teach the children how to ice fish. And they taught them very like strategic ways to drill into the, you know, creeks and the lakes to get the ice out and then to trap the fish. They taught them how to hunt the saber-toothed tigers, and they taught them how to chase away the little woolly mammoths who were eating up their crops. So I'm totally paraphrasing, but essentially the nature of the story is this: the Ice Age came and the ice began to melt and the waters became muddy, but they continued to teach the children how to ice fish. And so the kids would go out and the waters were muddy and every technique they did was not effective and they were not catching fish anymore. And the little woolly mammoths, you know, they disappeared and the crops disappeared and the saber-toothed tigers died off because they didn't have anything to hunt. And the tribesmen, the cavemen, got together one day and they said, we have a problem, you know, because they had refined their curriculum. Mm-hmm. Question, why do we do what we do? Because clearly our success rates are not very good. And one of the core leaders, he stood up, he said, it's because it's tradition and you do not break tradition. And so the moral of the story, it's much longer than that, is why do we do what we do? Is it because it's always been done that way? Is it because, you know, that's how you were taught? That's how I was taught. But listen, we have entered now the fourth industrial revolution. And they say that 60% of all jobs that we are training for today won't be there in just a few years. And so I look at it this way, we're doing a disservice to students. If colleges don't get ready and we don't prepare for the tough questions and we don't ask ourselves the tough questions on how do we redesign to prepare our students for the jobs of tomorrow? You know, why does it take 6 years to get a two-year degree? Well, most students are working either part-time, full-time. They have families. Even if they don't, a lot of our students work. Yes. And it takes them so long to complete that two-year degree. Mm-hmm. You know, even math. Why do we have math set in the tracks that we do with math pathways? Mm-hmm. Math, college algebra can be a great barrier to impeding a student to even complete college. So these are the questions we begin to ask here at our institution at TCC. And actually through it, we redesigned math pathways. We had an 80% success rate in our college algebra courses, as opposed to, I think it was like 63. I mean, it went up dramatically.
Wow.
And because we were willing to ask these tough questions. I'm not saying it's easy. I don't think it's just, oh, you know, it's a one and done.
Right.
It's a constant asking the questions, what can we do better? And how do we think even deeper to impact change? And so I really encourage you to read that book. Yeah. But the lessons from it, I think, applies to everything we're doing today. We're in, like you said, you mentioned something. You said this pandemic, it's an opportunity. Nice. And I think what we've learned through this is that the Zoom meetings, it's an opportunity. We're seeing an opportunity to engage students that may or may not have had the same level when you have to come to campus for things. We are now finding ways to have outreach that is actually makes it easier, I think, for our students. And so I'm looking forward to the future. I think we have a lot, you know, ahead of us as a nation. But I believe now is the time, if we're going to impact change, now is the time to rethink this process and not just do it alone. We need to be talking to these business leaders and workforce engine, you know, company owners and asking the big boys from Amazon, Google, what do you see is coming down the pike?
Yeah.
Because I promise you, the changes are coming quickly and we need to be on board. And I'll close with this. I always say, and this is not something I created, actually, it was a saying that goes way back to the very foundation of the community college philosophy during the Truman Commission. But I will say this, we are the Ellis Island of higher education. And so people come to community colleges with a hope in their heart. They come with a dream. I know we talk about, you know, the American dream, and some people say, well, you have to be asleep to have it because it's, you know, you have to be asleep to have the dream because it's not reality. But that's not true. There's no other nation in the world like our country that gives people opportunity. And so I really believe the community college, we have the opportunity to really change our communities and our societies through building up the workforce through the very types of students I'm talking about. You know, they're brilliant, they're intelligent, they have so much to offer. They just need to know that they belong and they have a place and that they're going to make change for tomorrow because they're coming up with the solutions themselves. And so, Melanie, if all goes well, I'd like to do a next book on the future of work and learning, and I'll keep you posted.
Oh, good. I will bring you back and we'll talk about that one too. This has been wonderful. You just gave me chills in your last comments there, because you're right. The Ellis Island of education, that is powerful and so very true, right? That opportunity, that hope, that's what we're founded on. That's what drives so much of who we are as a nation. And so when you boil it down into how that's personal and how education, you know, I've always viewed education as the door, the keys to the door that unlocks your future. Right. And so, that's amazing. Well, we, I'm so grateful that you joined us today. As we close out, is there, anything you'd like to call to action? You'd like to send out have people, you know, follow you on a social media or say the name of your book again, whatever, however you'd like to promote.
So kind. Thank you so much. So the book is called Overcoming Educational Racism in the Community College. You can actually find it on Amazon. And my Twitter handle is at EducateUSA. I guess I went big, right? Some people are like, I had at EducateUSA. And you can find me on LinkedIn, Angela Long, but I'm happy to share any materials in terms of what I've looked at, worked with, and I'm happy to connect you and any of your audience to some of the amazing authors in these books. I mean, they have a story in and of itself on what they're facing in their communities and what they've done to help students. In fact, the president, Oklahoma University, he's mentioned in the book, they actually have Seminole State College, forgive me. But they have a picture, it's a statue of an Indian on the front of their campus. 28% of their students are American Indian.
Oh, wow.
And so he talks about this statue. When you walk into the campus, it's the first thing that greets you. It's huge. Mm-hmm. And it's one of the chief, right, of one of their key tribes, and he is holding a stake in the ground. And there's a story about that chief. There was a time when, you know, their tribes were being attacked. And of course, the first response with most people is you run if somebody's coming after you, you know, to take you out. This particular tribe and this particular chief said, no, I am staking myself in the ground and I will not be moved here. And if I die here, I die here, but I will not be moved. And so they actually tell their students, you need to stake your purpose in the ground. Don't let anyone push you away. Know your purpose, know where you're going, and don't be moved. And so I guess, you know, in closing, I think that's really powerful for us to hear that, because really we all have a purpose, right? And we all have a stake in education in terms of what we're trying to accomplish, but we really have to put our stake in the ground and just say, we will not be moved. And push forward with hope and faith and just do your best work and connect and partner with the right people that believe in your work.
Yeah, so. Absolutely. That's amazing. Thank you so much. This has been so wonderful.
Melanie, you are lovely, truly. I am so happy I got to meet you. And Whatever you need from me, you tell me. I am happy to help you. And so if there is a person you'd like me to connect you to, I'd be happy to do it. But I just wish you the best and your listeners the best in everything you do and much success in your work.
Thanks so much. Thank you so much. I will be in touch soon too. And I will hit you up for that list for sure. All right. Have a wonderful afternoon.
Thank you again. I appreciate it.
All right. Bye-bye.
This has been Dissecting Education with your host, Dr. Melanie Hicks, a production of In Pursuit Research. Outcomes driven, impact focused. Thanks, and we'll see you on another episode soon.